Across the Sky is proudly sponsored by Weather Call Services. Don't be caught off guard in severe weather. Choose Weather Call. Hello once again, everyone. I'm meteorologist Sean Sublett, and welcome to Across the Sky, our national Lee Enterprises weather podcast. Lee Enterprises has print and digital operations in more than 70 locations across the country, including in my home base here in Richmond, Virginia. I'm joined with my colleague Joe Martucci at the Jersey Shore. Matt Hollner is off, and Kirsten Lang is on assignment. And we've got a wonderful guest this week. Our guest this week is Andrew Dessler. He's a climate scientist at Texas A&M, director of A&M's Texas Center for Climate Studies. His scientific research revolves around climate feedbacks, how water vapor and clouds act to amplify warming and the CO2 that humans emit. He's previously, and it's been a while now, but worked as a senior policy analyst in the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. As a very well-respected climate scientist, we had one of his colleagues on earlier, Zeke Hausfather, out there in Berkeley, California. And Joe, man, this is a great, I'm not gonna lie, I just totally geeked out over this episode, man.
When we were talking about the different power sources and how we're powering in the future, that was really interesting. I always am interested in just energy. I read a book once all about the power grid, and then I should say I listened to it as an audio book. But anyway, it was a very good conversation, timely as well. Report came in from NOAA. It's official. Was the hottest year on record for the globe, fifth hottest for the United States. And by the time you're listening to this, it could be very cold where you are as well. And we know that in Texas, where he was, ERCOT, the big power provider, they had issues. What was it, 2022, Sean? Maybe early 2022?
I thought it was early 20 or 21. I don't know.
Maybe 21. Either way, I don't think it's going to be that kind of cold. That's not our forecast. But it's just pretty timely to have him on. So we appreciate his time and his viewpoints on that.
Yeah, as NASA NOAA reporting, it was the warmest year on record, but at the same time there's a cold outbreak going on in the middle part of the country, and he addresses that in the podcast and where there are connections and where there may not be connections. This is a great conversation. So stand by. Here's Dr. Andrew Dessler from Texas A&M. Dr. Dessler, I saw the tongue-in-cheek form letter for media inquiries about 2023 being the warmest year on record globally. So I know this is the kind of thing you get a lot. So I want to step back a little bit and ask you, are there one or two questions you would prefer to answer in this space right now? I mean, I know you get the same kind of stuff repeatedly, but are there one or two questions you would like people to ask you that they're not asking?
So let me start out by giving some context to the quote that you're referring to. And so for years, whenever a record comes out, I get emails from reporters saying, can you give me a comment? And, you know, after a long enough period of time, it's like, you know, what is there left to say? It's warm record. You know, this is going to be the rest of our lives. Every few years, it's going to be a record. It's always going to be one of the hottest few years. And so it was sort of a joke on how predictable the questions are, and also kind of the challenges that the media has, and they've got to make something interesting. You know, there has to be a news peg. There has to be something, a story. And, you know, one of the problems with climate change is that it's this slow moving catastrophe. And so how do you keep people interested when the news is exactly the same every day? Sort of it's this very slow drumbeat. I'm not trying to criticize reporters for asking me the question. I sort of understand that, and I'm glad they're covering it. You know, it would be far worse if they didn't cover it. But I think that the important thing is not that we're having these records every couple of years. It's another, you know, record hot year. It's really, I think the important thing is that we still have the ability to control how much warming we have in the future. And while the warming is turning out to be, I think, a lot worse than people expected. I think, you know, 15 or 20 years ago, people would have said 1.5 degrees warming is not going to be that bad. It's turning out to be a lot worse, I think, a lot worse than people expect. And that means that 3 degrees of warming is going to be much, much worse than people expect, but that we still control how much warming that is. You know, we're living through an energy revolution right now. Renewable energy is now the cheapest energy we have. We know how to build a grid that runs primarily on renewable energy, even though it's intermittent. We know how to handle that in a way that's not expensive, and we just have to do it. You know, what we're lacking is political will. So I really love to talk to people about the solutions to climate change, because we have solutions. We just don't have the political will to enact them.
Well, can I get you to talk a little bit about the intermittency problem just for a moment? Because in my communications, this is what I run up against the most. I mean, I understand that battery technology is beginning to scale up. But in terms of conveying that message about how we're managing the intermittency problem.
Yeah, that's a great question. That's really what I think people don't understand, is that a lot of really smart engineers have been working on this problem for the last, you know, 1 to 2 decades. And we now really understand how to handle that. And the way you handle intermittency is when the sun and the wind is blowing, you run basically on wind and solar. You build enough wind and solar so that on most days you're running 100% renewable energy. Now, you're not always going to have wind and solar available. So on the days that you don't have those, you need some kind of dispatchable power. Now, in the future, hopefully it's things like batteries or hydrogen that you generated with renewable energy. But right now it could be natural gas. And so people have done calculations that with a reasonable build out of wind and solar and leaving the existing natural gas infrastructure intact, you could power the U.S. with 90% renewable energy. You'd only have to be running the renewable energy on average 10% of the time. Now, during certain periods, natural gas could be 80% of your power, but those are very short periods. And most of the time, you're running 100% wind and solar. And you could, if you did that, you would be paying about what you'd pay with a dirty fossil fuel grid. It's not that it would cost more. It would just require us to make the effort to build out the wind and the solar. We can do this. We know how to do this.
I'll dive into that a little bit more here. You know, natural gas in terms of, you know, where it sits on the pollution scale, right? How do you go about, you know, explaining that as we do transition from, you know, fossil fuels into a more renewable environment? You kind of hit on it there, but natural gas, and I'm not an expert in fuels, but I know there's still, you know, pollution with that, right? So where does that sit on the scale in terms of being clean or not clean or whatever, maybe somewhere in between?
Right. So if you think about sort of the things we use to generate electricity, there's coal, there's natural gas, there's nuclear, there's renewables, there's hydroelectric, things like that. So the worst fuel by far is coal. So coal is, Dave Roberts, who's a well-known blogger, calls coal the enemy of the human race. And, you know, I'm not sure I'd go quite that far. I mean, we developed on coal. We should tip our hat to coal since it got us where we are. But as of right now, you know, coal's got to go. It's expensive. It's dirty. There's no reason that any coal plant should still be open. Or put a little differently, I think we need to be rapidly transitioning away from coal. So natural gas is better than coal. And in fact, a lot of the emissions reductions that the U.S. has seen over the last 15 years is due to a transition away from coal towards natural gas. Natural gas produces a lot fewer air pollutants. It produces fewer CO2 molecules per joule of energy generated. So it's clearly better than coal, but natural gas is still a fossil fuel, and it still produces air pollution. It still produces carbon dioxide. And I think one of the underappreciated aspects of fossil fuels is all of the negative the larger scale negative aspects of fossil fuels. For example, fossil fuels are a huge hit on our national security. Look at the war in Ukraine. look at the ability that Russia and Saudi Arabia have to change the price of oil at, essentially at their will and tank the U.S. economy. You know, these are and natural gas is subject to those things also, since natural gas is now a globally traded commodity. So if the price in Europe goes up, the price in the U.S. goes up. And so we've seen changes in natural gas price here because of the war in Ukraine. You know, people talk about energy independence. The only way to be truly energy independent is to get off fossil fuels. We cannot drill our way to energy independence. We can only do it by using renewable energy. So natural gas is better than coal, but it's not, you know, it is at best a transition fuel. But even in many cases where you think, well, we need to transition to natural gas, you know, you're better off transitioning to wind and solar. And when I talked about the when I previously talked about how we can go to 90% clean energy and 10% natural gas, this is a study, Berkeley 2035. You can Google that if people are interested. Their point is not is we don't build any new natural gas. It's not the case that we're building wind and solar, and we're also building natural gas. We're their thought experiment or their plan to get to 90% renewable energy by 2035 is to use the existing natural gas infrastructure. You just use plants that are already built. And that's the way I kind of think about natural gas. Natural gas is the runway. We're not building more natural gas. We're not expanding the infrastructure. We're just using it to help us transition to natural gas, to help us get off coal. I think that's really where it's where it plays. But we don't want to be building a lot of natural gas. That is, that would be a mistake, because it locks you in to fossil fuel use for, you know, 50 years. Usually when you build big infrastructure, you're planning on running it for half a century. And you don't, you just don't want to be building something that commits you to using that for that many decades.
All right. So are there any examples of somebody, whether it's one of the United States or somebody abroad? I hear a lot about Germany. I hear a lot about California, that may be leading the way or is kind of doing this in the right way, or at least ahead of the proverbial curve. Are there any examples that you can kind of cite?
China is the country that we need to look at. And, you know, they're succeeding basically because the government there made a decision that renewable energy is a future, and they are building a huge amount of renewable energy. And more importantly, they're building the industrial base so that they can export that to the rest of the world and make a lot of money doing it. In 2007, I testified before the Texas legislature, and I said, you know, renewable energy is the future, and we have a choice. We can either develop it here and sell it to the rest of the world, or we can buy it from, you know, Europe or China. And by God, they made the decision to buy it from China. You know, it's just the height of lack of insight and you know, being short-sighted. You know, it's like, we're going to stick with fossil fuels. It's you know, this is not a good long-term political solution. But, you know, China really, it has taken the bull by the horns, and they're going to make a lot of money selling renewable energy, or selling, you know, solar and wind and batteries and all the technology associated with green energy to the rest of the world. And we're going to be buying it from them.
I still hear a lot of noise about, even though China is building out these renewables, they're still building coal also. And I can't get past how accurate that even is, right? There's so much bad information out there, right? So what do you see as kind of going on over there? Are they still building more coal in addition to renewables, like throwing spaghetti on the wall, or how is that playing out over there?
Well, Sean, I'll interject real quick, because I have this up from U.S. Energy Information Administration.
Okay.
And we were going to ask the same question. Okay. You know, what the website's telling me is that 58% of primary energy consumption in China is coal, and is the world's largest exporter of coal, going into, you know, what your point was there, Andrew. So, you know, is it, are you saying China's kind of doing the best and maybe the worst things at the same time?
Okay, so certainly when you have a grid that runs on solar and wind, you have to have some dispatchable power. And, you know, coal is the power of China. They don't have a lot of natural gas. They don't have a lot of oil. So they have relied on coal. And I think it's unrealistic to expect an economy to to just stop building coal plants. I mean, this is a transition. They have said for a very long time that they're going to peak their emissions in 2030 and then get to net zero in 2060. So that was what they, at least peaking in 2030 is what they told Obama in 2014. And it looks like they're on track to do that, but they still have to build coal-fired power plants. Now, the important thing to understand is that the key metric is how often are they running the coal power plants? And as they build more solar and wind, the capacity factor of coal has been going down. So they don't run their coal plants quite as often, but they still do have to build them just because, you know, wind and solar is dispatchable. But clearly they're building batteries. They're investing in other technology. They're building nuclear power plants. They will at some point shut those down.
Well, I want to follow up with one more thing, not about China or coal, but, you know, where I'm in New Jersey, nuclear is our second biggest energy producer here. There's a lot of NIMBY, not in my backyard. We get it in New Jersey. We understand that our nuclear power plants are in fairly low populated areas. And we just closed one that was in a relatively populated area. What research have you seen or have done in relating nuclear into the future that we do have? And I feel like the buzzword in maybe the past 2 months have been small nuclear, these small facilities that you know, may have potential. Just want to see your thoughts on that. And nuclear fusion, I know, just became possible, or at least there was more energy being created as opposed to going into it. I don't think it was by much, but your thoughts on that.
Okay, well, so let's rank nuclear technology. So fusion, just stop talking about it. I'm not even going to talk about that anymore. It's not in our lifetimes. All right. So small modular reactors. Obviously, we know how to build them. You know, we have them on nuclear submarines and aircraft carriers. You know, multi megawatt power plants. The issue there is nobody's really built a commercial one at reasonable price, and you have to realize that there's always a learning curve to new technologies. The first ones that come out are going to be really expensive. And so they haven't even built one. When they do build one, it's going to be expensive. And then over time, as they get experience building them, it will get cheaper. So, you know, on a multi-decadal time scale, it may be that small modular reactors will be important, but not in 10 years. I mean, we're talking 50-ish years. In the meantime, it's always important to remember, you know, we have wind and solar, and they're dirt cheap. They're the cheapest power. So we already have, admittedly intermittent, but we already have cheap renewable power. So then what about sort of conventional reactors? So conventional reactors, we built them, we know how to build them, we know what the price is, and the price is a lot. And so the question then comes down to, if you want to generate power as cheaply as possible, what do you do? And the answer is you don't build a grid that's nuclear. You build a grid that's solar and wind that has some dispatchable power, maybe natural gas, maybe batteries, maybe hydrogen in the future. That's the cheapest grid. And the reason it's cheap is because, I don't know how far into the weeds you want to go on this, but natural gas is extremely cheap to build. Most of the expense is buying the gas. So you have very low capital expenditures, you have high operating expenditures. And what that means is you can build a natural gas plant and just leave it sitting there. And then 10 times a year, when you need it, you turn it on, you run it. You can still make money doing that. In fact, in Texas, we have what are called peaker plants, which are plants that only run when the demand is extremely high. And those are natural gas, and they still make money because they charge a lot, because they run when the power is really expensive, but they don't run all the time. You can't do that with nuclear. Nuclear is the opposite of natural gas. It has extremely high capital costs, extremely low operating costs. So if you build a nuclear power plant, you have to run it all the time. If you only run it a few hours a year, you will never make money, or you have to charge just exorbitantly high costs. And so nuclear, I mean, I do think there is a role for nuclear for providing some baseload power that you know is always going to be there, that you can run it all the time, especially if you can get the price down with you know, future developments in nuclear. But it's just not, nobody who's actually run the numbers suggests that the future is a grid that's primarily nuclear. It's just not, the numbers just don't work out.
That's very, Very telling. So I appreciate that because I've been talking to a couple of people here in Virginia, Dominion Energy, and they've renewed their two nuclear facilities at Surry and North Anna well into the 2050s. So they're clearly not going anywhere.
Oh yeah, can I add something? If you have a plant that's running, do not shut it down. That is absolutely insane to take offline existing nuclear power plants. I think that they are big sources. Right now, they are a big sources of carbon-free energy. It's really the question of, do you want to build more plants? And I think that so let me just be clear, we should not be shutting down sort of competently running, safe existing nuclear power plants. There's some disagreement on that. There are people that say we should shut them down, but I strongly believe that we need to keep all the carbon-free energy online that we can. You know, even though, yeah, we should be doing that. That's my personal
Got
opinion.
it. Got it. All right. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back on the other side and talk about some of the ways this might play out in the coming decades to come. So you're listening to the Across the Sky podcast. We'll be right back. Hey, everyone. Across the Sky is proudly sponsored by Weather Call Services. Don't be caught off guard by severe weather. Choose Weather Call. Get precise, location-specific alerts via phone, text, or email. With over a decade of experience, WeatherCall delivers pinpoint accuracy for your exact address, ensuring no surprises. Take charge and stay prepared when ominous skies loom. Explore the WeatherCall difference today. Visit weathercallservices.com/leeenterprises and safeguard yourself, your business, or any school that matters to you. You can also find that link in our Across the Sky show notes. weathercallservices.com/leeenterprises. And we're back with Dr. Andrew Dessler of Texas A&M talking about climate and solutions to climate change. We've all heard by now that 2023 was the warmest year on record. You know, the big question is, so what? So where do we go from here? I think those are the operative questions. We know what causes climate change. This is not a surprise anymore. So we think about the solutions going forward. And Dr. Dessler, you've been in the policy space for a long time now. And I know you were talking with your colleague Zeke Hausfather about this earlier, who was also on the podcast and is great. But you've seen how human behavior acts. You've seen how politics acts. How do you envision the next 10 or 20 years going? I mean, I could have hold you this, and you know, you don't have a crystal ball, but seeing what you've seen already, knowing that we are in the midst, or at least the beginnings of kind of an energy revolution, how do you imagine this may play out in the next 2 to 3 decades?
Yeah, I mean that's a good question, and you know, I often think about when people ask me questions like that. You know, it's extremely hard to answer, and I think back to the 2000 election, Bush versus Gore, which was essentially, for people that may not be, I wrote, some of my students weren't alive then, so a lot, maybe some of your listeners don't remember that. I remember that very well. You know, that was decided by a few hundred votes in one county in Florida, and the way the world evolved was completely different. If Gore had won, you know, we would not have invaded Iraq, for example, in 2003. You know, it would have been a completely different world. Our take on climate change would have been different. I think Obama wouldn't have been elected, then Trump wouldn't have been elected. I mean, the world would look completely different today based on that. So I think trying to come up with a prediction of how the world will evolve, a single prediction, is probably foolhardy. A lot of it will depend on the elections this year for president and control of Congress. I think Biden administration is going to look very different from Trump administration as far as their policy on climate goes. You know, I think let's talk about sort of what we can achieve instead of, I think, what we will achieve. You know, I've always thought trying to limit warming to 1.5 degrees was very, very, very unlikely. You know, when people started talking about it, like in the Paris Agreement, I thought of it as what people sometimes call a stretch goal, which is like you're gonna start trying to lose weight, So you're going to try to lose 40 pounds. That's your stretch goal. Now, if you only lose 30 pounds, you're happy. Okay, I didn't make 40 pounds, but I did really well. It's a goal that's there to motivate you. You don't necessarily think you'll reach it, but it's there to really push you. You know, if you're trying to run a 4 minute mile, you know, you might, that could be your stretch goal. You might not get there, but if you run a 4:10 mile, you're super happy. If you lose 30 pounds instead of 40 pounds, you're happy. If we get to 1.6 or 1.7 degrees, I would be pretty happy. 1.5 degrees again is a stretch goal. I think 2 degrees is really what we should be aiming for as not a stretch goal. It's something we really want to achieve. I think it is achievable, and it's something that we should be really trying to keep the warming below 2 degrees. It's still going to be tough. There are going to be a lot of really bad impacts, but as I said, I don't think 1.5 is achievable, but somewhere between 1.5 and 2 is achievable. It really depends on the politics. And, you know, I can't predict the politics. I'm not even going to make a guess of what's going to happen. In the US and around the world, fossil fuels are incredibly powerful politically. And in the US, they essentially own a lot of the legislators who then legislate on behalf of fossil fuels and not on behalf of the citizens. I see that every day in Texas and, across the US and around the world. You know, a lot of it will depend on whether democracy wins or whether democracy doesn't win, because I think democracy is really hanging by a thread in a lot of places, including the U.S.
Yeah, it is tricky. And that's another rabbit hole we could totally go down. But in terms of the policies globally that are already in place, a lot of the numbers I see right now say that we're on a path on current policies to do about 3 to 3.5 degrees. And we're talking Celsius here of warming by the end of the century. Is that still kind of the governing idea in the climate science community, that, you know, the absolutely worst, burn all the coal forever, that idea is kind of gone. So, you know, 6 and 7 degrees C, that's, we don't say it's impossible, but it's exceedingly unlikely. Is this 3 to 3.5 idea kind of where people are right now?
Yeah, that's right. In my mind, I sort of say 3 degrees Celsius, which is about 6 degrees Fahrenheit, is kind of the canonical that would be today's business as usual. Now, the caveat with that is that it is extremely hard to predict technological innovation in renewable energy. And 10 years ago, nobody would have predicted that the price of solar energy would drop by 90% and wind would drop by 70%. In fact, on Twitter, there are these memes of people making fun of the EAI and the IEA, actually different organizations, their predictions of the deployment and the price of energy. I mean, the price of solar energy now, today, is well below what the predictions were for it in 2050. I'm thinking that the best case scenario, because I'm not sure we have the political will to solve this, is that renewable energy just gets cheaper and cheaper at a rate much more rapid than people expect. And that's really what will push the deployment. That would be, without government oversight of the transition, it's going to be messy and painful. You know, that might be the best hope for us limiting the warming, just sort of this increasing innovation in the energy space, driven a lot by government spending in other countries like China. You know, if you ask the question, why did solar drop so quickly? It was because of government support in Germany and China, primarily. Some in the U.S. in the 90s and the 80s, and Japan in the 90s, but it was a lot of government support. And if countries decide that they want to make a lot of money in renewable energy and start pumping money into their renewable energy industries, that could really drive price drops, which could help the rest of the world transition.
I want to go back on a point you said a few minutes ago, which is fossil fuels are very politically powerful or have a lot of influence here in the United States. What we'll say developed countries are there out there where maybe there isn't this political pressure? Maybe it's just not for fossil fuels. Maybe it's not for any kind of specific, you know, type of fuel. But what other countries out there? Is it Canada where fossil fuels aren't that powerful politically? Are there countries in Europe where the solar industry is powerful politically? Could you give us a landscape of how that looks?
Yeah, fossil fuels are powerful everywhere. They're powerful in Canada. They're powerful in Australia. It may be Europe sort of the EU is the place where they have the least amount of power. And the reason is because they don't have a lot of fossil fuels. You, if you want to find a place where fossil fuels don't have a lot of power, it's a place that doesn't produce a lot of fossil fuels. So it's not the US, it's not Canada, it's not Australia. They're all big fossil fuel producers. So it's the places that don't produce it that really see the benefits of renewable energy. Europe got hammered by the war in Ukraine because they were relying on natural gas from Russia. I mean, there's no better example of why you don't want to be dependent on natural on fossil fuels than that. And so, it's hard. I mean, fossil fuels are a multi-trillion dollar per year business. So it would be unthinkable for them to not be spreading that money around to ensure that we continue to use fossil fuels.
All right, to follow up a little bit on impacts, as we've already seen a lot of impacts, obviously, just from the sensible weather, more energy into the system as a very short version. Are there other two or three impacts, either domestically or globally, that are going on with the warming climate that just aren't as obvious?
Yeah, so I think the mental model that people need to have is this idea that climate change is going to have zero cost to them until one day it wipes them out. So in science, we talk about non-linearity of impacts. You can think of a hockey stick. There's sort of zero, and then all of a sudden, boom, you hit the blade, and the impacts go way up very rapidly. And that's the way climate change is. So for most people listening to this, they're probably thinking, we've warmed 1.5 degrees. Yeah, 2023 was 1.5 degrees Celsius, about 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit above the pre-industrial, but it hasn't affected me. And it probably has affected them. You know, some prices have probably gone up. They're spending a little more on air conditioning, but maybe not major. But what's going to happen is one day, something really bad is going to happen and it's going to wipe them out. You know, the classic example of sort of non-linearity is you live next to a river, and every time it rains, the river level goes up. And because it's raining, we're getting more intense precipitation events. After it rains, the river is getting higher and higher. There's no impact until one day it gets high enough that it floods their house. And the damage goes from zero to $100,000 of damage in an hour. And that's kind of the model people have to have. It's not the case that things are getting a little bit, every year things are getting a little bit worse. It's things are not getting worse. And then one year things get truly terrible. And there's a lot of data, especially, flooding is a classic threshold phenomenon. Either your house floods or it doesn't floods. And I know in Virginia, where you guys are, I guess where Sean is, you go down to the peninsula, Norfolk and those places, Virginia Beach, it is those places are right on the edge of having, going from zero damage to extremely high damage when the water rises the next inch of sea level rise. And so, there are people, so I think that there are two kinds of people out there. There are people who have already been severely affected by climate change, and there are people who haven't. And the difference between them is one storm, one heat event, one thing. So, hopefully all of your listeners haven't been desperately affected by climate change, but some of them will be in the next year. I hope it's not you all, but somebody is. And, that's the nature of climate change and climate impacts.
Do you think it's fair to call it a climate crisis?
Well, crisis is obviously not a scientific term. There's no scientific experiment you can run that says this is a crisis. It's a personal judgment. I personally, having seen the data and seeing how bad the impacts are with just 1.5 degrees Celsius, 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit of warming, I consider it a crisis. That's a personal choice.
What, if any, presidential administrations have you worked with over the years about climate change, or have they come to you and your work on the state level as well, being at Texas A&M in Texas?
Yeah, so in the late 1990s, I worked in the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. So I was their staff atmospheric scientist at the time, and I answered questions. I didn't really do any policy work. That's not OSTP's job, really. It's to provide science advice for the president. And since then, I haven't done any work with any government agencies on climate policy. In Texas, the last people they want to talk to is us. I mean, they literally would start at the front of the phone book, aardvark and end at Zizage before they would call the Department of Atmospheric Science of Texas A&M. They do not want to talk to us. The good news is at least they leave us alone. They don't actively go out and harass us, but yeah, no, they have no interest in talking to anybody who knows anything about climate change. I mean, there was a great quote of after some flooding in Dallas of reporters asking Greg Abbott if the flooding was connected to climate change, and he wouldn't even say the words. The reporters were trying to get him to say the words climate change, and he literally would not say the words. And ERCOT, famously, the people who run the power grid in Texas, they don't incorporate climate change in their predictions. Texas Water Development Board wrote a multi-hundred-dollar Texas water plan for the next 50 years, doesn't include the terms climate change. So yeah, it's a state that's deeply in denial.
Yeah, that we hear the news coming out of Texas, and we think about our colleagues there in College Station a lot.
I guess I would one thing, if you guys have obviously seen the weather forecast coming up for the coming week, it's going to be very cold. And every time it's cold, you get sort of, as I call it, a blizzard of bullshit. I don't know, you can bleep that if necessary. You get a blizzard of bullshit about the people who say this is a consequence of climate change, more cold events, or people say this disproves climate change. And I think so. It obviously doesn't disprove climate change. Even in a warming climate, you still get cold events. I am personally skeptical that climate change is driving more cold events. I know there are people I respect who believe there is a connection. I don't. I'm not convinced, and I think a lot of people in the field are not convinced. There's no consensus that climate change is driving more severe cold events. So I think I don't know exactly when this will come out, but I don't think that this cold event says anything about climate change at all.
All right, Dr. Dessler, thank you so much for joining us and taking the time, and keep doing what you're doing, because we need more people like you. So thank you, sir.
Yeah, no, this is a great discussion. Thank you.
Wow. Joe, one of the things I like about Andrew Dessler is he does not hold back at all.
He does not hold back. He shared his opinions on this podcast as well. Super knowledgeable just about, how we interact as humans with the climate. And really, I feel like the past 10 years has been an inflection point on how we want to or not want to act on climate change. And obviously, Andy has his thoughts, but also a lot of a lot of data and a lot of information to back that up. And we it was good to have him on and hear from what he had to say.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who are well invested in this space mentally, intellectually, professionally, in terms of what the solutions are. And a lot of them are straightforward, but implementing them is obviously a challenge in this day and age. But I think it's good to bring some of this stuff forward in light of this being the warmest year on record, 2023. And as he has said many times, it's going to be like this more often than it's not. In the years ahead. So it was good to have him on. So, of course, we're in the midst of a cold outbreak and it's going to be cold. But
Yes.
with that, we've had snow in some places. Some places have gotten a lot of snow recently.
Yeah.
So, next week, we're going to be looking at road weather data. Head of automotive at Vaisala is going to be looking at road weather data and the future of automated vehicles. So, that's coming up next week, conveniently, as we get into really the core of the winter season and some of the coldest here so far this season across America. Anything else, Joe?
It'd be interesting the day where it's snowing outside and your hands are off the wheel and you're in a car and it's navigating through sleet and snow and slush and all that good stuff. Be interesting podcast. I don't
It
know. I don't know
would.
how I feel about it yet, but I'm sure just like a lot of things in life, you get used to it.
Maybe, but that's going to be a tough thing to really give up. That's going to be a
Yeah.
tough thing to give up. And if it's sleety outside, I just assume stay home with a cup of hot cocoa.
Hey, that's true. And hey, one more thing too, while we're on the topic of cold. If you are a listener who lives between North Carolina and New York. Sean and I are also your snow surge team. Every Wednesday, we look at snow, ice, and cold threats for the following week. Broad forecast. We're not saying your house is going to see 2.3 inches of snow, but some broad forecasts. Been really popular this winter. It was popular last winter as well. So if you're listening from there, we'd invite you to check it out. New episodes, like I said, come out every Wednesday. That's a video episode, and you can find that on your local news website, or just type in snow search in one of our names and you'll see it there
too. Yeah, Google's good that way. But yeah, anywhere from North Carolina to New England, we look at snow and cold threats, not so much the next couple of days, but in that longer range in the 1 to 2 week period ahead. But with that, we're going to close up shop for this week for Matt Holliner and Kirsten Lang, who are out of the office this week. Joe Martucci in Atlantic City. I'm meteorologist Sean Sublett. Thanks for joining us, and we will talk to you next time.
See you guys.